Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Wednesday, January 21st. And I think what we'll do, first of all, as Senator Berger comes in, is open up a work session on our committee rules, and then we'll begin the activities of the day. So with that, I'll open up an organizational meeting. Colleagues, before you are the proposed committee rules, which my understanding is are identical to our other committees
that
we have had, and there have been no changes to those.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move approval of the rules.
Senator Starr has moved approval of the Senate Committee Business and Transportation Rules for the 2009 session. Discussion. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I brought this up in the other committees, and it seems at this point to be a little dismissed, but the way I read the Senate rules on that all amendments need to have, there's no conceptual amendments in our Senate rules, it seems like Rule 19 on clerical errors, or clerical amendments, does conflict with the way they're drafted, the Senate rules.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing we're going to ignore that, but I just wanted to point that out for the record. So,
thank you.
I will be voting for the rules.
I
just want to point that out, that they seem to conflict.
Thank you, Senator George. And, we don't know who's all listening, but since there may be a minor conflict between the two, we'll try to use whatever one suits our purposes as session moves forward.
Situational ethics.
Okay. Is there any other comments? Any objections? All right. So ordered. I'm going to open up an informational meeting on transportation system investment, funding Oregon's transportation infrastructure. Senator Berger, as you were just walking in, I want you to know that Senator Schrader is with us from D.C. She is here on the speakerphone, and she's also watching us on video. So she is. We have an interesting quorum. Technology has made us, audio and video, so we're considering you part of the quorum and until told otherwise. So we're just delightful that we have a full committee here today.
And Chairman,
yes.
I would just like to add, I really wanted to thank Dan DeSimone. He's the director of the Washington, D.C. office for the governor, and it really has been through his help that I'm able to participate today and tomorrow, and I just wanted to thank him for that.
All right. Thank you. Yes, thank you very much. The purpose of our meeting this afternoon, colleagues, is just to begin not only our session, which is going to be a very, very difficult one for all of us in many ways, but also very important and one that's filled with opportunities. And the fact that they are difficult shouldn't dissuade us from where we're trying to go. And we have a great opportunity this session in these difficult times to work at building infrastructure that will help the state not only today, but a few years from now and years down the road, and helping private business to grow and expand in transportation infrastructure, as we have heard all the way back from D.C., where Senator Schrader is, to our conversations that we have had for years now. You're all veterans of this experience. This is a real opportunity where we can help. And our challenge will always be finding that sweet spot of managing the funding with the work that is to be done and bringing everyone together. One thing I have been very, very proud of is this committee, and I know, thanks, Senator Starr, because we've been longstanding now together on this committee, and Senator Berger, who chaired this committee at one point, and Senator George, who joined us last year, is that despite all the difficulties of the legislative process, after a decade-long drought of funding anything in transportation, we have now gone four consecutive sessions of successful investments in transportation infrastructure. And I know we are all committed to make that five in a row, and this time perhaps the most significant one that we have ever made, and perhaps maybe even more important. So I'm excited about it. We all know it's going to be challenging. What I would like to do today, and I'm going to invite a few people up, and we're just going to have an open discussion today about funding transportation. I think everyone in this room, those who are watching, and certainly all of us, are certainly well aware of the need, and I don't think we need to revisit that at the moment. What we want to talk about, though, is, and how do we find that mix of revenues that balance the users of the system, those who benefit from the system, starting to hear from many of you who we have been working with in the interim, trying to get some insight from you as to what's part of these funding opportunities you're most excited about. If you have some, 40,000-foot concerns about some, to begin that discussion today so that we can put together an integrated system that will meet everyone's needs and, most importantly, those of the citizens of Oregon. So with that, I want to begin by asking that Chris Warner and Hans Bernard come up representing the governor's office and indirectly ODOT as well as the governor's office, who has been working very, very hard on the governor's proposal, which we are all very familiar with. And kind of give us a way to, as a starting point for this discussion of how we're going to fund our infrastructure. So welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Chris Warner, the governor's transportation liaison. I think as we were in front of this committee, or the interim committee, talking about the governor's proposal in early November, so we can talk a little bit about those details. I think what the chairman had asked is for us to give kind of a little bit of a discussion of the process that we went through during the interim, and Hans will talk a little bit about some of the values and strengths of the proposal and what we did. So certainly it was over a year ago that the governor asked a number of stakeholders, and they were folks from every part of the building, but also from people outside the building, people from the environmental community that haven't necessarily been in part of those conversations. We had the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. We had just a plethora of people that were gathered, and we had discussions. We met for weeks on end, it seemed, to come up with kind of a list of priorities. And so the governor designated what were called three committees. One was the Vision Committee, which kind of came up with the proposal and some of the most important features of it. He also had another subcommittee called the Governance Committee. And what we did in the Governance Committee was take a look at some of the structural issues that confound us as we move forward with transportation, some of the barriers that we have, some of the ways that we spend the money, and whether or not it's we're using wise use of the public's dollars. And then the second was what we called the Public Affairs Committee, which kind of wanted to have the conversation with the Oregonians on exactly how do we move forward with that, and what are some of the issues that people are looking for, and kind of as we move forward into the session and working with legislators on how we kind of put all the pieces together to make sure that we're asking the right questions, but also answering them correctly as well. So there'll be a number of documents that you've heard of over the interim, and I just wanted to kind of outline a couple of them, and then we'll move on to some of the things. I mean, first is the Vision Committee report, which we issued in early November, and that this is the Vision Committee report. It basically goes through all the findings of the committee, and we basically looked at it a number of ways. First, we had what we kind of called the transitional pillars, which were kind of the foundation for moving forward on what we wanted to do in the future. And then we talked about some of the transitional first steps, some of the changes we would need to make the law, and some of the other things we need to move forward in order to get those transitional pillars. And then we talked about the investment strategy and went through if we were able to raise some additional dollars, where would that money be spent. And then we also tried to explore some more future-looking things in terms of how do we take this transportation system from what we have now and not only transform the transportation system, but also look at the way we funded it. So those were kind of the premises we did when we looked at that. Kind of the second piece was the Jobs and Transportation Act, which we brought forward last time we were here. And what the governor did, he took a look at some of the recommendations of the committee and then came forward with what his bill is. And that actually had been transformed then into 2120, which was a House bill that was introduced. Because of the revenue measures, it was introduced as a House bill. So those are some of the documents that we worked on over the interim, and certainly many of you helped us with those conversations and were also part of it, and many of the people behind us. It's an old home week seeing all the folks that have been working with us on this. So we're excited that and we're appreciative of your having this discussion, because it's vitally important in terms of where the governor would like to take the state, and I think Hans will talk a little bit about some of the principles that we had when we moved forward with this.
Let's go ahead with you, Mr. Bernard, and then we'll have a conversation.
Sounds good. Thank you, Senator Metzger. Senators, for the record, my name is Hans Bernard, the governor's deputy legislative director. Over the course of the last year, I worked with Chris in consultation to staff the governor's committees. And as Chris mentioned, when the governor pulled together that group of stakeholders about a year and a half ago to ask them for their assistance in developing a transportation package he could submit to you, he outlined five core principles that he found or thought were critically important in any transportation package that might work its way through this building to his desk the first, and I think this has gained in importance over that time period, is economic development and job creation through transportation investments. The second would be preserving the systems that we have currently in place and enhancing them where appropriate to ensure that local decision-making processes and identifications of priorities are put in high value. The third would be to continue the governor's legacy and the great work that you have done over the past few sessions to ensure that policies across the policy portfolios in Oregon are some of the most sustainable in the country and environmentally friendly. The fourth would be knowing that it is always difficult for you to ask constituents for additional resources for any investment, whether it be transportation or other priorities you may find, to ensure that there was appropriate levels of transparency and oversight in the spending of those dollars, so the public knew that they knew what that investment was buying, so that they could track and ensure that that was a wise investment and one that was spending their dollars efficiently and effectively. And lastly, and this is probably the most important, is to ensure that any transportation package benefited the entire state. The governor felt very strongly that this could not be a proposal that benefited one region of the state over another, but really touched all of the communities where Oregonians live and ensured that we were making investments in preserving and maintaining the existing system, but also making strategic capacity enhancements throughout the entire state where appropriate. So those were the key sort of guiding principles that the governor asked the Vision Committee and others to consider as they helped him draft a proposal. Those were the touchstones that he used when he took that report and decided on the provisions that he would be forwarding on to you that are now incorporated in House Bill 2120. I think that the governor is very committed to ensuring that that any bill that lands on his desk this session is one that incorporates those principles, but also continues to take a thoughtful look about how transportation investments are made. And as the Chair Metzger mentioned in the outset of this conversation, ensuring ways that we can avoid decade-long droughts in this conversation to have a more sustained and consistent investment in the transportation system. So with that, Chris and I would be happy to respond to any questions or comments that folks may have.
Okay, well, thank you. First, as an observation, and I've shared this before, when we had this presented to our interim committee back in November, and certainly members of the dais have been working on this as well, is I do very much appreciate the governor setting a very high target on this, because we know the needs are so great that we're going to have a discussion of where that ends up and where it comes from. But I think in order to be able to effectively communicate to the people of Oregon that we are going to deliver on whatever package we put together, we're going to have something of significant size in order to actually hit the finish line. And so I think that was a very good starting point. My first question, and then I'll open up to members of the committee, is since this was put together, our own economy has continued to fall like a knife, as well as the national and the global economy. Is there any change in approach, revenue generation sources, any change that the governor has thought about in the package that he is presenting in the House from when that was done, based on any change in the current economic climate?
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, certainly one of the things I think when we it was an interesting process to go through as we started the discussion of where we go. Gas was like $4 a gallon, and now it's fluctuated quite a bit. So there were many changes and many variables that went into it. I think the core principle that I don't think has changed for the governor is this is a job creation package. Certainly we're looking at about 6,700 jobs per year for the first 5 years at least. And as part of the process, we've identified not only things that we can get on the ground as soon as possible, but also big projects we need to continue to move forward. And certainly we think that any work that would be done on the federal level in terms of a stimulus package would enhance the work of the Jobs and Transportation Act, because a lot of the work from the stimulus package is the list that we put together are things that we have to get on the ground immediately within, I think, like 120 days. And I think that will be a great shot to the economy and getting some jobs for a lot of the folks that are, I saw Bob Shiprack came in, and a lot of his folks are actually out there, you know, needing the work. So that'll be kind of the first shot. And then as our bill comes forward, I think that will kind of be the next level of investment to kind of continue it going. So I think with what's going on the federal side, I think it actually, they mesh very well in terms of having that immediate shot that's going to come forward with the federal stimulus package, and then to go ahead and move forward with the new dollars as they're generated from this act. So
I have one other, then I'll turn it over to Senator Starr. One thing different about this than, say, our Connect Oregon, where we're using existing dollars, is the lag time. Even on projects that we want to do right away. Right now, the committee will be meeting this evening to consider capital construction maintenance that can go right away in various state facilities and colleges, because we're using existing dollars going to the bond market, and they can start. With a funding package such as transportation, it can't take effect until 90 days after sign you die. So it is September at the earliest that we would know for certain, even upon passage, this was available. And then you have the lag, even on initial projects that we may want to get on the ground, based on the system. So in order to try and tighten where we can tighten and constrain the timeline, say on maybe any early significant job creation projects we may want to do in the final product, it would seem to me that one thing we would have to consider, and I would be curious if the governor would consider this, is using some of his executive powers of emergency declaration to get these on the ground. And I'm saying specifically we have a lot of environmental impact statements, other reviews that just take a lot of time. And while I'm not suggesting that we waive this for everything, a lot of the projects that the Oregon Transportation Commission has already considered in different jurisdictions, and I'm thinking particularly on new capital investments, have already been vetted to a significant degree. But just the bureaucracy of that, you know, can get in the way of our good intentions. I'm thinking in terms of Highway 35, which of course was a federal partnership. When that got washed out between Hood River and there was a health and safety issue, that crossed the White River Canyon. Under normal circumstances, replacing that road would have been 6 or 7 years. And, you know, we got it fixed in 2 months because we used those emergency powers. Is the governor, in order to, because of job creation and because of this noted lag time that's built into our system, is the governor willing to use his executive powers to expedite some of these projects so that we can faithfully tell Oregonians that we're going to get them to work as soon as possible?
Chair Metzger, I think that's a conversation that we'll have to go back and have with the governor, but what I can say is, given the anticipated federal stimulus dollars, I think the department is going to be busy over the course of the summer if those dollars do come in a timely fashion, and will probably be busy with projects that are creating jobs over the course of the summer months through the September timeframe construction season. In terms of any revenue generated from a bill that you may act on this session, I think it would be an important conversation to have, but again, I think we'll have to go back and talk with the governor on that.
Fair enough. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You raised the question that was foremost in my mind. The reality is that we're faced with an emergency situation. The unemployment numbers we received yesterday are disheartening, and I think are going to continue to go in the wrong direction. If we are in an emergency, let's treat it as such and move these projects quickly. We saw in the Mississippi Bridge collapse in Minnesota a process whereby they rebuilt that bridge in less than a year. And, you know, it's a bridge that's actually bigger and longer than the Columbia River crossing. They built it in less than a year for less than $250 million. And it seems to me that we have a unique opportunity to actually keep faith with Oregonians, and with they're the ones that are putting their tax dollars, you know, to us, giving them to us to use, and we have a significant opportunity to turn around in this emergency condition environment that we're in and really put people to work. So that's something that, quite frankly, it's going to be high on my list of items that we include in any kind of package that we pass, that we really, because, you know, we've been involved, most of us on this committee over the last, as the chair mentioned, over the last several sessions, getting projects passed, getting transportation proposals out of this building, and really at this point, some of those bills that we passed 5-6 years ago, just today, projects are getting under construction. Long time after the initial bills were passed and the taxes were raised, in the environment we're in today, we can't afford that. And I think Oregonians will demand that we get these dollars out into the ground, on the ground, as quickly as we possibly can. So I join with the chair to encourage you all and the governor's office to work cooperatively with us to do that in a fashion that makes sense. You know, I think none of us are thinking we're going to set aside all rules and regulations, but I think there are places that we can go to facilitate and expedite these projects.
And Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, I would add that I think that there will be some ways that we can learn lessons through the federal stimulus process. I know that there are expectations that Congressman Schrader and his colleagues will now have on both the governor and the state agencies in terms of implementing those dollars in a timely fashion. So I think that from our perspective, we would be committed to gathering any lessons that we learn in that process and bringing those to you so they can be put to good use as we move forward.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, add one thing. I think as we move forward, a lot of projects haven't. I know there are some very complex projects that have taken a long time that, you know, still aren't off the ground, that and not as quickly as any of us, you know, particularly the department, would like done. But certainly, there's a lot of things that could be done, I think, that if we had some additional resources that we could hit the ground running on pretty quickly. So I would like to say is that if there are additional resources, I think the department and the commission and the governor are extremely interested in moving those as quickly as possible. We might not get to some of the, you know, the bigger ones that are very complicated, but I really do believe that all working together, we would be able to spend that money very quickly and put boots on the ground. So thank you for those comments.
Just an additional follow-up.
Yeah.
Another question, different topic. Federal programs that require state match, that, you know, we all know that federal dollars generally come with some sort of state match. Recently been made aware of the Airport Improvement Program. I believe it's a 95-5 match. Mm-hmm. My understanding is there's a significant amount of federal dollars already sitting there waiting for states to basically apply for these dollars. Can you comment on whether it makes sense from your perspective for us to go, you know, for basically 5 cents on the dollar, get an infusion of the federal cash for these airport projects, where we can turn around and put people to work paving airports, expanding airports. Again, that's an opportunity to grow Oregon's economy. If Senator Johnson were up here, she'd be pounding the dais talking about how that grows Oregon's economy. I'd love to have a response on that from you.
Yeah, Senator Metzger, Senator Starr. In fact, I think the last time I was in front of this committee, I mentioned multimodal and didn't mention aviation, and I heard about that from Senator Johnson, so I do appreciate that. Certainly, the AIP program is one that we're very interested in. Most of the gas tax dollars, obviously, are you can't be spending those on the airport improvements. But we do, within the JTA, we have a multimodal account, and one of the, I think, a very good use of that money would be some of those federal funds that are matched at a pretty incredible rate. It's just sitting there. And then there's also a Connect Oregon 3 component to the bill, which is an additional $150 million, and I'm fairly certain that that we did access some AIP dollars. We did use that as a match, because one of the criteria for Connect Oregon 3 is ability to match, and you can use your federal match for that. So I think that would make them highly competitive for Connect Oregon 3 dollars. $1 million. And Dan Clem, who is the director of the Department of Aviation, has worked very hard to try to keep some money in the department. He's done a terrific job trying to get that department straightened out, and so he has what is called the FAM grants that he's been working on. But AIP is also another critically important airport infrastructure improvement program on the federal level. So thank you. I think it's a great idea to get those funds flowing through that.
Okay. Other questions for these two gentlemen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had a very thoughtful process with your committees. I appreciate having an ability to put some information on the table through the governance committee, and I think having as many people as you had at the table was a really thoughtful process. I think we'd be remiss, however, if we didn't look at our local partners here who may have projects ready to go at the cities and county levels. We know that the public sees those roads, travels those roads every day. I think it would be certainly appropriate that you look at that for a way of processing the money.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Any other questions? Thank you, John.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask that, since they're sitting side by side, just like the Bobbsey twins, Bob Russell and Craig Campbell to come forward, representing AAA and the Oregon Trucking Association. And and mentioning that I know you have both been very involved in this process, and I appreciate your diligence and commitment now as we started this at the end of 2007. But I want to check in with the pulse on some of these issues. I know you not only participated in the process, but you have seen not only the governor's proposal, but you have talked and weighed in on all these different issues. And I'd like to try to drill down a little bit on the funding source of this. And I'm going to start with you, Mr. Campbell. I'll go to you, Mr. Russell. If you could just share with the committee your thoughts on the proposals that we are initiating with at this point. You know, what part of it that do you think, in terms of your membership, that is strong, that you feel that is moving in the right direction? If there's some parts of that that you think we're going to need to have continued conversations on? This is early in the session, but I've learned over time that, you know, you don't want to wait to April to kind of figure out where we need to start working. So if you could give me your overview of, and that's whether it's both the governor's proposal or some of the other ones that are out there that that gives you either heartburn or, you know, smiles to your face, we'd like to hear about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell, representing AAA Oregon, Idaho. Wanted to begin by thanking the governor and his staff and the members of the committee who have been engaged in this process for the last, since 2007. It has been a very collaborative process, and that has opened a lot of doors that we didn't have available to us before. Specifically referring to the chair's question, in general, AAA prefers, obviously taxes in general are never very popular, but to the extent that motorists are going to be paying taxes, the preference that AAA looks at is those that actually reflect use of the system, so that you're actually taxing people fairly based upon their use. We're a major proponent, and I won't speak on behalf of my friend to the right, but in the area of cost responsibility, that's a very critical thing to AAA. And generally, when you're talking about taxation along the lines of a gas tax is always going to reflect usage better than a registration fee, title fiends and things like that. So our preference is to err on the side of dealing with a gas tax rather than high registration title fees, because those in turn become more access taxes. You have to pay a large amount before you're able to use the road. That adversely affects elderly drivers, those on fixed incomes, and those sorts of situations. So generally that's our preference, is that it be a use tax. One of the things I did want to comment about specifically dealing with the governor's process is, for the first time, we actually had representation from the environmental community, and as a result of having an opportunity to work with them, we found out that there are some areas that we don't have a lot of divergence. And one of the things that I wanted to comment about is really the need. We have a dedicated highway fund, but we really need to look at finding a fund that is dedicated to multimodal, because the way those interact with each other give us some tools as to how we can reduce congestion without doing some things that disincentivize people specifically to use the roads to get to and from work, to and from the grocery store, to and from their doctor's office, or however they're using the road. So that's one thing that I wanted to emphasize. The other area specifically dealing with use taxes and the gas tax, we know that the gas tax over time is going to deteriorate and has deteriorated as a result of increased fuel efficiency from vehicles. And as we look at the advent of the electric vehicle, which doesn't use fuel at all, we're going to have to move to a system that reflects a taxation system that can capture their use of the road as well. Doing so cautiously because our members are a little nervous about the concept of putting transponders on vehicles and tracking where they go. So we have a lot of discussions that need to occur beyond just this initial transportation funding package discussion that we're having currently. With that, I'm certainly willing to have discussions about any number of subjects you want to drill me down further on, but that's my general comments at this point in time.
All right, so as I interpret it here, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Campbell, is that the bulk of the funding from your members' perspective is preferred to be the fuels tax. I didn't hear in your comments that you're opposed to raising registration fees or title fees, but that there's a threshold undefined at this point where that becomes perhaps a point of resistance, and that we need to find if we're going to do a mix of funding sources to keep in mind that the farther from your perspective that we moved away against the strict user fee versus the access fee, that you would start having a bit more heartburn. Is that an accurate?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And to the extent that registration fees, title fees, along those lines are dedicated to taking care of fixed costs versus use-related costs, that, of course, helps us as well because that's consistent with our policies.
Thank you. That's helpful. Mr. Russell, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I'm Bob Russell, President of the Oregon Trucking Associations. My membership is acutely aware of the need for additional funding for transportation. Matter of fact, we are desperate for additional funding for transportation. And it's not just for the trucking industry. It's for all of the freight modes, whether it be railroads, air, water, pipeline. The projections are that the volume of freight in this state is going to double between 2005 and 2025. It's going to take all of the freight modes working together to support Oregon's economy. And it's going to take investment in all of those freight modes to produce the required capacity so that we can successfully serve Oregon's economy. Of course, the economy is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And when we talk about the size of investment, there's sort of three different levels that we look at from the trucking industry's perspective. The first, obviously, is the impact on our companies. In 2008, there were 3,065 trucking companies that declared bankruptcy, and that's not little ones. That's trucking companies with five or more trucks. That is a huge impact on the trucking industry and the capacity of our industry to serve the nation's economy. That is a national figure. Sort of the second level of the economy that we look at is the trucking industry currently is transporting about 72% of the tons of freight in Oregon. So we are sort of the foundation underneath the economy. If our cost increase significantly, we will, of course, pass that along to our customers, which will have an impact on the economy across the board. So we're very concerned about our cost, particularly in this economy and in light of the volatility of fuel prices. Diesel fuel prices, as you know, as gasoline, are down today. The average the last week was $2.31 for diesel nationally. But during the peak periods, we were seeing diesel fuel at $5 a gallon in California, for example. And we certainly expect that the price of fuel is going to increase once again. So we've got that to contend with as well, and how the volatility in fuel prices plus other increased costs to the trucking industry affect the economy as a whole is probably our largest concern. If we tip the economy over, or over more than it already is, then that's not good for anybody. That means jobs. My friend Lynn Lerbeck is sitting here from the Joint Council of Teamsters in the back of the room, and he was telling me earlier today that his union hall is full of my members' employees that we've already laid off. So we're starting from a really difficult position. Sort of the third economic issue is we want to be successful with this. We've all gone through an experience where we were not successful. We passed a transportation funding package and it got referred to the voters, and we got our hats handed to us. We want to make sure that whatever the size is, that it's acceptable and that it sticks. So that's really key, and to both of us, I believe. And like Craig, I really appreciated working with the environmental community, and there's a number of pieces that we sort of worked out in that process that I think are very important for Oregon going forward. Craig already mentioned a dedicated fund for transit and other alternative modes. There's also in the governor's package a proposal to have the Department of Transportation implement a least cost planning model, which would take into consideration carbon and VMT reductions for automobiles. We think that that's a very positive direction. We sort of stole that idea from the utility industry, and it's worked very well for them, and we think that it can work very well for transportation as well. In that kind of scenario, the most cost-effective project would be built, but it would not be just in consideration of its transportation function, but it would also consider its impact on the environment, which we think is real positive. Another one is what's been referred to as the efficient fee method of cost allocation. Cost allocation is very esoteric. Most people don't want to talk about it. Craig and I live it. We both support it, and we support each of our constituencies paying their fair share for the use of the highways. But a few years ago, we experimented with an alternative method of cost allocation that's referred to as the efficient fee method. And basically, it allocates the full costs for use of the highways instead of the system that we use today only allocates the cost of the pavement. So what the system doesn't do today is it doesn't set money aside for future investment, for example, like you would in your business, and you would put money in the bank to buy capital assets in the future. We don't do that with our transportation system today. The efficient cost, the fee cost allocation method, in fact, does that. But even more than that, it also considers the externalities. If we're putting out pollution and it is harming the environment, it has a cost associated with that, and it includes that in the cost of using the transportation system, which we think is a very positive thing. There's a couple other pieces on the environmental front. Last session, you passed the Clean Diesel Program, which provides retrofits for not only diesel trucks, but all kinds of diesel engines, whether they be tugboats or construction equipment or whatever. That is a very positive piece, and we're hoping that the legislature will provide some additional funding for that this year. And lastly is the BETSI tax credits, which we use extensively to reduce our consumption of diesel, which definitely reduces our output of carbon. And that pays for things like auxiliary power units, appliances that are attached to the trucks to streamline them to reduce the drag, which reduces fuel consumption, rolling resistance tires, and other things that really help us reduce our fuel consumption. So we're concerned, we encourage you to also look at the environmental aspects of transportation as we go through this discussion on transportation funding. And I think I'll stop there and wait for your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. So I'll ask you what I asked Mr. Campbell, and that is, of the different sources of potential funding in the governor's package proposal, we heard from Mr. Campbell about kind of what a preference from his members. Do your members see any of those proposals as providing more angst or sheer joy than the others?
Well,
fortunately or unfortunately, most of them, or at least the controversial ones, would be on Mr. Campbell's members. So my only interest in those is to the extent that they might jeopardize our success. Quite frankly, we already have a vehicle miles of travel tax for big trucks called the weight mile tax, and we've been using transponders on our trucks since the early 80s. It's kind of fun for me to listen to the debate. I remember back in the 80s when we were talking about putting transponders on heavy trucks, and the truck drivers were saying, no, you can't track me. I don't want them to know when I go to lunch. I don't want them to know when I'm going to visit my girlfriend. All that stuff. Now you couldn't take transponders away from us. They've become an essential tool in the way we do business today. So it's kind of fun to watch. And as you folks are very well aware, when it comes to a transportation funding package, we're sort of the tail and cars are the dog. You decide how you're going to tax them, and then we figure out how we're going to do it with trucks so that we pay our fair share under the cost responsibility.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for either gentleman? Senator Berger.
Mr. Russell, I appreciate your environmental comments, and I appreciate some of the things that you've said, but I still haven't heard how you think it should be funded, other than you think we should put money away, and right now we're just trying to survive. So.
The environmental pieces that I talked about, the least cost planning and the efficient fee approach to cost allocation, are things that we'll have to develop over time. They're not something that will fund our highways immediately or have an immediate impact on the discussion. But they're certainly something that we need to pursue now so that they're available to us for the future. How we should fund it now, it's more of an issue of how we determine a mix of different funding instruments can be successful with the public and with Mr. Campbell's members, and then you'll tell us how much we owe, and we'll increase the weight mile tax and registration fees. Is that answering your question?
Not really, but I thank you for the response.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure you heard the comments earlier by Senator Starr about the Mississippi Bridge, and we all have examples of where a bridge that we're proposing costs $4 to $6 billion here, costs whatever, a couple hundred million someplace else, and we can point to examples all over the world where the procedures and the process and the institution and all the bureaucracy on top of what we do not only prolongs all of these projects, but then makes them incredibly expensive. I got examples in my district of $2 million bridges where a culvert would have worked because of environmental regulations, and there's no fish going through the underneath the bridge. It's still just a wet spot. And what we have is an institutional system that has upped the costs of our transportation system in the state. And I think it's been politically correct up to this point to go along with sort of the cost build-ins that we've had in the system because it's been politically correct. But both of your sets of members are going to pay the costs, and in essence, we're being asked to raise taxes on Oregonians who are losing their jobs. And I think at some point it's time that we say, fine, if we can pay for all of these wonderful things, great. But if we're going to put in a transportation system that the voters of the state of Oregon are going to support, it has to be about expediting the process and drilling those projects in at the lowest possible cost to get return on investment. And what I mean by that is that the only way we're going to create wealth in these types of projects is to make sure that we're building projects that actually get goods to market, goods to the port, gets people to work in a way that's expedited. And I guess I appreciate all the things that the both of you said, but what I heard is that you're asking us to raise taxes on our constituents in a time where the economy is down, and I don't think this economic situation so far has forced us to start looking at how do we do it in a much more cost-effective way. And I guess my pressure back to all of you would be is that I think if when I talk to city government folks, when I talk to county government folks, when I talk to contractors, every single one of them has a private list of all the things that we should be doing differently in this state, but they won't say it out loud because they're afraid of the political implications. And organizations like yours could lead the charge in starting to talk about the places where we could find and to expedite this process, not only build our projects faster, but also in a way that they don't cost so much money. I've got a project, well, I've got several projects in my district. I believe at least one of them has now been on the planning books for 40 years. You know, I mean, at some point it gets ridiculous. You cannot build transportation systems in this state in a cost-effective way. And if we can build a project across the Mississippi River for hundreds of millions, and we can't do a replacement bridge in Oregon for less than $4 billion, we've got an institutional problem. And I guess what I'm not really asking a question, I'm just making a statement. We need your two organizations to lead the charge to break apart the political correctness discussion, and actually let's talk about how do we get asphalt on the roads, and how do we get new capacity to get our trucks through the state of Oregon, how do we get our freight there without necessarily talking about all of these wonderful things that are great when we're all fat, dumb, and happy, but not so great when businesses are actually trying to get containers to the port, try to get containers onto trains, and trying to get their employees to work. And that's simply what I'd sort of make as an opening statement as my frustration in this process so far.
Can you hear the comment? Senator Schrader, by the way, you can always, I know you would never neglect jumping in, but I want you to know that, you know, feel free to jump in any time that you would want, and don't feel shy, and I know you won't.
Maybe just let me make one statement here. And I am listening very intently and taking notes as I learn at least about this issue at the state level, having worked at it at the county level. And I just one comment that this will lead me to ask staff to really get a thorough analysis of what some of these cost drivers are. Because at least with my experience at the county level, it actually has been the exorbitant rise of cost in the kinds of materials that we are using for the construction that seem to be some of the major drivers. So for me, it would be useful to get a review of that, what have the increases been, where they've come from, and juxtapose that against some of the other regulatory environmental pieces, because I'd be curious to see, to get a really clear picture from my perspective of what really are those drivers. I think that's a good analysis that will serve this committee well.
Thank you, Senator Schrader. I think that's an excellent idea. I think we can ask the department. We might just select a couple of our larger projects that have been completed under either OTIA 2 or 3. I'd love to see a pie chart broken down into labor cost, materials cost, planning, architecture, et cetera.
I think that would be just so useful because, as I said, I think this notion of the cost is actually very, very complex, and that would be... I think it would help this committee move forward with what we need to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you,
Senator.
Okay.
Mr. Campbell has a comment, and then I'll go to Senator.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is actually going to Senator George's comments. One of the things that we discovered in the discussions we were having is a lot of the regulations and processes you have to go through before you build aren't coming from one location. They're actually coming from several different locations. Oftentimes they conflict, and oftentimes they represent a body of administrative rules that have built up over time. I don't think anyone has ever gone through the process of a cost-benefit analysis as to whether or not those rules are still accomplishing what they're trying to do and if they're doing so in the most cost-effective way. So that sort of a process probably would help us in the cost impact that has on our transportation building process.
Well, yeah, and that's a very good point, Mr. Campbell, because for those who have been involved in the legislative process for a long time, they talk about all the different bills that we pass out of here. Truly, 90% of the bills we pass are fixing things that were already in law that, for one reason or another, people think are not working very well. And your point is very valid, and I think that goes to what Senator George said and Senator Schrader is sometimes, as we know, I know in the... Committee on Rules and Elections. You know, we just passed laws that now then got so many rules and no one can figure them out, and we do this very well as complicating things. So that is going to be an important part of you know, stepping back and say, how do we deliver, as Senator Starr pointed out, the results in difficult times, and be sure to look at the end goal, the public good, as opposed to, this is what the rule says, but does the rule meet the public good in today's current environment? Senator Starr.
You know, it just struck me as we've kind of had this conversation and Senator Schrader's ideas. It would be fascinating to have somebody, and I don't know who the appropriate person might be, but I would guess that somebody in the audience, some organization in the audience, might have the right kind of analyst that would do this, but to take that Mississippi Bridge in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, and do an exercise whereby we analyze that project, if it had been built in Oregon under Oregon's typical rules, and compare the axles with, you know, what it would have looked like if we had built that in Oregon, you know, kind of like the process we're undertaking right now on the Columbia River crossing. That might be a very illuminating analysis, and I don't know who might be prepared to have the tools to undertake such a thing, but I see maybe somebody at ODOT might be able to do that, and Chris Warner is looking at me, but I don't know if Mr. Chair, if you want to.
Senator Starr, Chris Warner again. I think that could be a useful exercise. Certainly, when we talk about the Columbia River Crossing, one of the things that we're talking about, a lot of the work we're doing now is dealing with the federal EIS. So there's, I think, in terms of where we are, I think the federal process is lengthy enough in terms of what the state adds to it. I mean, we try to add to that. But I want to say about the Columbia River Crossing, getting back to that, I mean, it is more than just a bridge. In addition to that, it's a number of interchanges on a 5-mile. It's a 5-mile stretch of road. We'll also include light rail. So there's a lot more elements than just replacing a bridge that fell down. So I just wanted to say that for the record in terms of the CRC. But I'll talk to folks back at the department and see if we can come up with, you know, I think it would be an interesting, one of the notes I'd written down during this discussion is how they built that Mississippi Bridge, because I don't know exactly the process. But I think we could try and find that out for you, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
Nope.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. John Charles, I see you sitting in the back of the audience. This is kind of an open-ended thing. Would you mind commenting? What I'm doing here is, these are the people who pay. You know I got a lot of people who say, I want the money, but people who pay are trucks and cars, and to that extent, Mr. Charles essentially represents the payers, too, but with different perspectives. So I would love to hear from you.
Thank you, Senator. Honored to be here. I did scribble some conceptual outline yesterday that I was being passed out to you now, and I just want to share a few thoughts on it. By way of background, my name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, a research center based in Portland. And more relevant to this discussion, I was appointed in 2001 to the Oregon Road User Fee Task Force, along with Senator Starr and Senator Berger, where we spent quite a bit of time in the windowless conference rooms talking about this issue of the legislative mandate to us was come up with a plan for moving away from a gas tax to a pure road user fee. And I'm a big fan of road user fees, and I appreciate the fact that the governor has embraced the idea in part in his big mega bill, but personally, I'm not convinced that we need a pure fee, that is to say, collected on every single mile driven everywhere in the state, as was envisioned in the fee task force pilot project that most people here know about. I think that has a lot of problems politically and technically. It also has problems for actual implementation of congestion pricing, which I do think is necessary. And so my little conceptual outline here of what I think would be simpler and more fair and intellectually defensible is potentially to split off the highest VMT portion of the state. That is, the state highway system accounts for about 13% of the road miles, but about 60% of VMT. Why not take that and begin to do a pure user fee, including time-of-day road pricing, but not with a GPS system. Just use the transponder technology and overhead gantries that are used all over the world, easy-pass systems that many Americans are now view as comfortable. I mean, Oklahoma Turnpike went all electronic 18 years ago. It's not that radical anymore. If we were to do that, and then you could start possibly with a congestion pricing demo in the Portland region. The federal government for the last 5 years has been dying to get local governments to do more aggressive pilots of congestion pricing. Portland has chosen not to try and do that, although they've been invited to by the feds and with money. But if you were to do that, have congestion pricing, set the toll rates for all cost recovery, as well as the point that Mr. Russell mentioned earlier, expansion costs. Those toll rates should be set so that you have some money moving forward, and we get away from this fantasy funding we have where we think there's a Santa Claus in Washington, D.C. or somewhere that's going to constantly bail us out. I mean, that's not an adult way to run a system. A turnpike is completely self-financing. So if you need to do a Columbia River crossing, and not a $4 billion Christmas tree project, but something much less expensive, or a Newburgh-Dundee bypass that ought to be done and connected to the system, but it's difficult to self-finance purely by itself, but it could be financed if it was part of if I-5 and other highways were all had money in a turnpike, then you could pay for incremental expansion. It solves a lot of problems, and it gets the new capacity that we desperately need in the state. And particularly in Portland, if we're going to do a congestion pricing project, the primary reason should be to ensure mobility, to actually get rid of congestion, which involves not just one or two tier prices. You have to have maybe a dozen. And the whole point of setting the price is to ensure 55 mile per hour speeds or better 24/7. That's what you're selling to the users, is speed. Reliability. I mean, we're all speed freaks, whether it's high-speed internet or the highway. We just want to get somewhere, and the social benefits of that far exceed the cost of the tolling, if done properly. Now then, all the local roads, I don't think we need necessarily to have this pure user fee thing with a GPS device. I think they can be financed through combinations of gas taxes, property taxes, because local property owners are huge beneficiaries of very localized roads, SDCs and levies, those kinds of things. Washington County has done a really good job of passing levies regularly for capital projects benefiting only Washington County property owners, and they do a really nice job. I agree with Mr. Campbell earlier that I am not a fan of increasing fixed fees, ownership fees. You may have two, three, or even four vehicles technically that you own, but you can only drive one at a time. Well, the cost you impose on the system is typically at the use level. That's where we should be moving to. So I would actually, unlike the governor's package that is sort of grabbing money everywhere, which mostly has the result of really making voters mad, I would, if we're going to move to a turnpike system that's kind of a tough sell, you give voters something back by saying, you know what, we might even reduce your registration fees, or go once every 4 years so that you reduce the hassle of doing it, and gradually reduce the access and put the emphasis on the actual use, including a set of tire fee, which those of us on Rough Top came to conclude is necessary. The primary source of road wear is heavy axle weights, or more precisely, weight per square inch of tire, if you really wanted to do it that purely. Heavy axle weights and studded tires. Regular cars and pickups and SUVs are almost irrelevant. If we don't include studded tires, then they're just free riding and everyone else has to pick up the tab. It's very intellectually defensible to do that, and it's also politically defensible if you're lowering some other taxes and not trying to tax everything at once. I also support the effort that I believe is underway in Portland to seek authorization for bridge tolling. The first Morrison Bridge was a toll bridge, and Barlow Toll Road was a toll road, and it's a long-standing idea, and I think the county should have the ability to do that. The benefits of doing this, I've summarized briefly. If you have the limited access system, you could start with Portland Highways. You could go to the entire interstate highway system. I'm sure you could get federal waivers to do that. And then potentially other parts of the state highway system that sort of act like limited access highways, even though they aren't. You could gradually make that all self-financing. Then you get ahead of the curve, and we have a lot of catch-up to do. Second is the congestion pricing done properly would dramatically increase peak hour throughput. Now, it's counterintuitive for people to think of this, but down in California, we know from, I mean, SR-91 is possibly the most studied highway in the world. And you have four lanes of congestion tollways in the middle and then, quote, free lanes next to it. Well, at the peak of the peak, the worst day, which I think is Friday eastbound, the congestion price facility has double the throughput per lane per hour, which means that congestion pricing done properly doesn't toll people off the road. It actually tolls them on. It allows the same chunk of concrete to move twice as many people, so you get much more efficiency from that. And the reason is it's similar to either saying we should all stampede out the door at the same time or we should try and do it more efficiently through some way. Well, stampeding reduces people's ability. And our open access system now that is perceived by motorists at the margin to be, quote, free, causes this stampeding effect. Congestion pricing gives people what they want, which is to go really fast. The economic benefits of freight and people moving fast, potentially doubling the throughput, or at least increasing the throughput, maximizing the investment already there, therefore minimizing the amount of expensive new capacity. So all that is a benefit. Consumers have shown a high willingness to pay elsewhere when what they get in return is a demonstrable service they want, that they can always go fast and count on that time. And also, from the standpoint of the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals, if that's important to the state, this is the cheapest way to reduce CO2. I mean, when you're sitting in traffic going nowhere, you're burning a lot of fuel, a lot of CO2. You get those cars into a steady flow, you can reduce VNT CO2 by 60, 70, 80, 90%. And the cost of that as a strategy is actually zero. Because you should do congestion pricing for other reasons. It has net social benefits for other reasons. Greenhouse gas reduction, bonus, freebie. That's not in the governor's package. He's got a lot of other thoughts about greenhouse gas reduction, but that's not one of them. And finally, when you do this, you create basically virtual busways. I mean, congestion pricing creates virtual busways. Now, suddenly, if for transit, you have all you have to do is buy a few buses, and you have these really fast ways of getting around. It's a big speed advantage to transit users. It'd be good to even deregulate the industry and allow some private competition, some private sector folks to get into that. And the cost of that, the capital cost to the transit users, zero, basically. And so it's just kind of another way of reminding us that roads are, by the way, multimodal. And this makes them even more multimodal. And so there's a lot of synergy there, and I really think that politically, people are willing to pay when they get something in return. And instead of trying to do increases everywhere, fuel tax, registration fee, this, that, and the other, have limit them, even reduce some maybe, and focus the conversation on the use. And I think a lot of interest groups will support that, and voters will if they know they're going to get something, including the next generation of new roads and hopefully the next generation of new highways, which is never talked about but desperately needed. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of thoughts, John. First of all, I have had congestion compared to congestion that we experience in the United States compared to the bread lines that folks in Russia used to have to endure, you know, under a communist system. You know, we basically are forced to sit in congested roadways because of a lack of supply or a shortage. And Americans, for I don't know how long, I mean, don't suffer shortages usually. I mean, generally there's a market that comes in and rectifies that problem, that imbalance. It doesn't seem to be the case under our current model in transportation. And what you've suggested here is really a market model that would deal with those shortages that Americans seem to be willing to tolerate on their highways. So that's just a comment you can respond to. But the question is, if we were to move toward a system like this, it seems to me that drivers would be concerned that they're going to be taxed twice. They're already paying a 24-cent gas tax, and then you want them to pay a toll on top of that, and not only a toll on top of that, but, you know, up to a dozen different pricing schedules. And what would you think about the idea of providing a rebate to Oregon drivers that, you know, use the transponder as a way to you know, handle that issue of, well, doggone it, I'm already paying, now you're going to make me pay again. Your thoughts on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Starr, yes, there is a problem of market mechanism not working here. We do wait in lines. We barter our time. We sit in time going nowhere. It is sort of egalitarian. No matter how rich or poor we are, we all get to waste our time equally. So instead of paying in time, why don't we just pay in cash and get on with our lives and our freight? And I think the issue you raised is sensitive. I think we have an educational process to do, which will let people know that there is no such thing as a free road. And even after it's built, there's always maintenance. But I think we should also say, if we're going to slice off a 5 or 10 or 13% of the system and make it a turnpike, then all the gas tax money currently going into it will be backed out and hopefully distributed to local governments, perhaps in a higher cut of the gas tax percentage-wise. And let people know, when you get on that and you have your transponder, and by the way, this is the new generation of transponders, takes up less space than your credit card and it costs $10. Well, earlier ones cost $25 and were three times bigger. When you get on that, you are now paying, and the gas tax money is going elsewhere. And they're also paying for the next generation of expansion that inevitably must come. And I think if we sell people that and they realize that money is staying on the highways, it's not going to be some ATM for some other unrelated purpose, they can accept that. If not, rebates of what you've talked about, I'm sure there's many variations on the theme. I think that could all be discussed and agreement reached in some way on something. I think you have to kind of get to the yes-no threshold of, do we want to take the most heavily traveled roads and convert them to a self-financing turnpike? If the answer is yes, then that issue, I think, can be accommodated.
Any other questions? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I guess the thing I found most interesting about your testimony was this part that you have written in your written testimony, and you discussed about SR 91 in California, and with 14 different rates. I'm guessing that what you saw, and you probably looked at the studies, you saw a lot of people making decisions based off the pricing. So, like, did employers change the times that they had their employees come in and go home, or was it more individual decisions? It looks like to me that what you would do is you'd get people to do things that we're trying to encourage them to do, but they're not doing because there's no cost efficiency to it. I mean, did you see companies and individuals making a lot of individual choices to get around the tolls at higher peak times? What was the...
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, they were already confronted with that problem. That area is so constrained. Well, all of us now, if we either can't anticipate how long it'll take to go somewhere, or we know it's going to be a massive congestion nightmare, we already have to factor that into how we do business, how we send freight, how we lead our personal lives. Because, again, we're bartering our time. We're already paying. What SR-91 does is provide congestion insurance, that when you positively, absolutely have to get there in a certain time period, then instead of bartering your time, you get on SR-91 Express and you go about 68 miles per hour and you pay cash. So from the employer standpoint, it doesn't matter. They already had a problem. And, we don't, to use another analogy, we don't price food in the grocery store because we're trying to suppress people's desire for food. We're just trying to make the system work better. And the result is we get lots of choices at typically declining prices.
Mr. Chair, I guess the question then is that what you saw, I'm sure, is a flattening of the curve, the peak curve. In essence, rather than seeing the sharp curve at 4 o'clock and dropping off at 6, what you saw is a much flatter curve that distributed more. So you use the asset in a more effective way because you had the capacity filled for more hours during the day.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator George, that's correct. The reason you have 14 prices and they're on the website and you know that ahead of time is you're trying to suppress the peak and you're trying to use what economists would refer to, I think, as a market clearing price. You're auctioning off capacity, whatever it takes, to keep traffic flowing. That's the thing you're selling. And people self-select into the peak price, the shoulder of the peak, the shoulder of the shoulder. And by spreading it out, you don't have people stampeding through the door. You have them sort of just on the edge of chaos, but so you get the maximum theoretical throughput that you want. And it's like all of us when we shop, you go and you look at the whole gradation of choices on the menu or in the store, and you're self-selecting in depending on your willingness to pay. And the prices have to constantly reflect willingness to pay and the ability to move people through. Because as soon as it starts bogging down, if you're not selling speed anymore, then you don't have anything to sell. And that has to constantly be reflected. In San Diego, in the I think it's 15 pricing, they have dynamic pricing that potentially changes every 6 minutes. And it's all set on keeping traffic flowing smoothly. Once you're in, it doesn't change. But before you get into that area, it can change. And it's sort of pure market pricing. It's all designed to keep traffic flowing, which ultimately is what the consumers want.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. I appreciate that very much. We'll have many discussions on this, and in terms of congestion pricing and some of these other issues, clearly not only Oregon, the metro area, the state, the country, is going to have to look more aggressively at some of these issues. And I appreciate your work on the Road User Fleet Task Force, too. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, now I'm going to ask Lana Butterfield, Roger Martin, and see, Dave Burrows is not here, so we won't hear from that railroad. I don't see Nanheim either. Okay, so let's start with Lana and Roger. Do a little intersection with the rail, part of our transportation system. And again, just to remind you, we're kind of focusing on the funding of this transportation infrastructure, both with what the governor is proposing, some other things, and as opposed to, boy, we need something done because that's why we have this. We all know that part. So, all right, I'll let whoever wants to begin first.
I'll begin, if you don't mind.
Sure.
For the record, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm the executive director for the Oregon Rail Users League. And there's something in the air in Oregon that makes collaboration possible. And OREL itself is a very unique organization because we include not only rail, all types of rail, but also shippers and ports and vendors who are interested in rail issues. And our meetings are open to anyone. In fact, our next meeting I wanted to invite you to is on February 9th, and Speaker Hunt will be our featured speaker. I've given you a brochure about OREL. It's our new four-color brochure and gives you a little picture of what we're all about. We wanted primarily to come up and say thank you to the legislature once again for the success of Connect Oregon. It's a very proven and successful program now. I've watched it develop over the years. The ODOT Rail Division has just published a brochure on Connect Oregon. I know that you all have received this. They didn't have enough for me to give for the audience, so we put it on our website, and I've given you
paper reduction. That's good for, carbon sequestration.
Yes, that's right. I liked one of the quotes that Governor Kulongoski put in the brochure. He said, "I'm pleased as I travel around the state to see the progress being made. Communities are experiencing the benefits of the strategic investments offered by this innovative program." And I wanted to relate to you. There's some examples in here, but I get invited to a number of the groundbreakings around the state that are a part of the Connect Oregon progress. And there have been comments from people who are involved in that of great joy about what is happening for them and for their communities. I remember, for example, a ticket seller with Mount Hood Railroad. She's become one of my friends, and she called me up one day and said, "I really thank you and the legislature for Connect Oregon because it saved my railroad and saved my job." And she was very appreciative. And I hear those kind of things all the time. We even have another groundbreaking this Friday. And if you're interested, I can give you more information about that. Connect Oregon has been important because it focuses on improving the connections between the highway system and other modes of transportation. And those modes would, of course, involve rail. So you've got short line and class one excursion trains and so on, passenger rail, light rail, all of those. And then in addition, marine and aviation modes would complete the kinds of projects that are involved in Connect Oregon. All of these have benefited, and all of them are members of OREUL. And we believe that that Connect Oregon is very important, and that Oregon's economy relies on the efficient and safe transport of people and products by land, air, water, and rail. So once again, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Butterfield. Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Transit Association. I'd like to speak just to transit in this because Lana's covered the Union Pacific, who I also represent, their views. If you have that piece of paper in front of you, you notice right under the Oregon Transit Association, it says public transit matters. And I'd like to just quote one thing that Fred Hansen said last week when he appeared before the House Committee to talk about winter conditions and how the transportation responded to it. He pointed out that TriMet has the seventh largest ridership percentage of the population of any transit system in the United States. Now stop and think, New York, Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, all of whom have had rail, commuter rail for decades, plus subway systems and so forth, and TriMet ranks seventh ahead of other cities like Cleveland, St. Louis, Los Angeles, Baltimore, San Diego, Dallas, cities like that. I just want to make the point that transit does matter, and that we're coming to you in strong support of the Oregon, the Governor's Jobs and Transportation Act. Just as an aside, when we talked about transponders and John Charles held up that transponder, if there's a reluctance of people, all they need is one experience like some of you have had and I had recently. Go to a place like Tampa, Florida. I was riding with my brother-in-law, and you come to a toll booth, and you have an option to stop and get in the long line to pay or use the transponder to go through at 35 miles an hour. And it only takes one experience like that, and transponders become something you want, not something that's onerous. The governor's transportation package includes key items for transit. Over on the left-hand side, it authorizes an increase in the payroll tax, and it doesn't say here, but an extension of that taxing system to the transportation districts in the state who are now totally and solely dependent on the property tax. It's going to be controversial, but it's extremely important. If you stop and look at the success of TriMet and Lane Transit, the two systems in the state that have a payroll tax and have had ridership figures going off the map and the success they've had, it's because they have financing available to them. In Salem, the Salem Kaiser Transit Systems had to stop service on Saturday for a couple of reasons. One, they just don't have the finances from their property tax levy, and secondly, it has to do with what I'm going to get to in a moment. We also have, for the first time, a creation of an ongoing funding source of $44 million of flexible funds, non-highway funds. And all of us have to understand that in Oregon, none of the gas tax or other fees goes to any form of transit, except that we do use the streets. But it's important to understand that TriMet, all the systems in Oregon are limited to some, usually the property tax and the payroll tax, and that we are not using any other funds. It also, we also acknowledge the same thing that Lana's talked about, is the key role that Connect Oregon has played, and you folks are extremely important. It's because of you, and I say this especially to the Senate Transportation Committee, because you're the experienced people, you were key in getting that established, and we really appreciate the effect it's had on transit, as well as the other forms of non-highway transportation. Shift over for a moment to the right-hand side. The transportation costs are skyrocketing. You were key in getting a budget note attached to the last session's budget for human services that said they should sit down and cooperate with the Department of Transportation to find out what the facts were about elderly and disabled transportation. And that's where the other portion of what I wanted to talk about, Salem's experience, comes from. The federal law, the ADA, requires that any system, bus system, that is fixed route, has a scheduled route, must supply within three-quarters of a mile on either side of that line transportation for those people, the elderly and disabled, who cannot access the main system. And that leads us to the special transportation in Oregon that has skyrocketed in the last 25 years since it went into existence. We have 3.8 million riders per year. If you included all the people that really need that service but can't get it, that would increase by 26%. And the pure population figures that you're going to see, the baby boomer population, the increase of longevity in life, the elderly and handicapped figures are going to mushroom in the next 30 years. And you can read the figures. I don't have to read them to you. We're going to have an increase that demands we absolutely have to find some additional funding. Salem cut back for one of the reasons is that they now don't have the obligation to supply elderly and disabled transportation on Saturdays. They simply don't have the money to do it. And that's why we need your help. The governor's package or the transportation committees recommended a 5-cent cigarette tax increase. We said that's not as much as we need, 5 cents. Unfortunately, between the time that was announced to your interim committee and the Monday when they announced it, it got reduced to 2.5 cents. It is now a line in the governor's. It's not in the joint, the Jobs Transportation Act. It's in a budget that, or in a tax bill that has all the tax increases, cigarette tax increases for other purposes. We hope to persuade you and the House Committee to transport our tax increase into the Jobs and Transportation Act bill. All of us know that if you're included in a package, you have a far greater success ratio than if you're an isolated bill passing, and we hope we can get your support in doing that. It's vital. If we don't get the funding, that the elderly and handicapped transportation is going to drop all across the state, and we really need your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. And that is the conundrum of that law, is when the expenses for that system, special transportation, are too expensive, the only way out of it is to cut all the other service, the fixed line service.
That's not a way to do it.
So it's counterproductive, and that is what we see. I know in Ashland, at Medford, that same issue is a paramount concern to the senior and disabled population there. I do kind of want to move on, but I will take any questions for these two folks before. Okay, we'll be seeing a lot of each other. Thank you very much for coming. Marshall Koba, Ryan Tribbett, and Bob Shiprack. Koba doesn't have anything to say, but he is very supportive, right? Thank you. And I'm only half kidding about that. For those listening outside, Mr. Koba represents the American Council of Engineering Companies, which, if they didn't put this stuff together, we could never build it. So a real key part of what we do. And appreciate your members for what they do, Mr. Koba. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. And I'm really glad I came today. This has been a very interesting conversation. A lot of ideas getting thrown out there. And I'm going to tell Senator George, he gave me a really good idea. I'm going back to my members that do highway construction and ask them to give me a list of things that they see out on these construction sites that could be done better to help facilitate these things. I think if we started asking those types of questions, as you suggested, friendly suggestions to ODOT about how to just make our process work better. I sat in on a number of the committees that Chris Warner talked about for a long year. Did participate in the decision making. Just to jump to the chair's question of me, as I generally fully support the package. Obviously, a lot of input in there. If there were a couple things I kind of wonder about, I think Craig Campbell could have given my testimony. If you're going to vote for a gas tax, why don't you vote for something that really does something instead of 2 cents? I don't know how that got in there. There was some general consensus, I thought, from the committees that bicyclists should perhaps pay something, and in fact, their person on the task force agreed to that. If you have the joy of cross using the Hawthorne Bridge in Portland every morning. It is now, it's something to behold. I mean, it's solid line of bicycles up Hawthorne and across the bridge. So it is indeed a form of transportation, at least in the city I live in. As an aside to that, my wife bought herself a Christmas present, a new bike, which she intends to use to commute. And I says, gee, that must have cost all of $150. And she got very red-faced. It was a $1,000 bicycle. These things are expensive, and I think that to have them pay a little bit would have been okay. The reason I supported the registration and title fees is because it was demonstrated to us that actually Oregon is below the national average in those areas. So I thought politically, you know, you can always say, well, we're going to at least get to the national average. It will be right there with everybody else. I am a little sensitive about elderly people, fixed income, limited amount of money to pay for that, but some increase is justified. I also like the comprehensive nature of the package. There was a lot of fun putting this together. There was some, as was mentioned, a lot of us haven't always embraced every environmental idea that comes along. But it was in a real effort to compromise and listen to one another's needs that we all agreed. I wanted to echo what Mr. Martin said. We also strongly support the transit portion of this bill as well. So, in fact, everything that was there as far as public policy. I'll stop with the transportation stuff itself, but the other part of the governor's has called this the jobs and transportation bill. I'll just tell you that we, too, are indeed interested in facilitating these projects. ODOT and myself, just as a little experiment a few months ago, surveyed the five crafts that traditionally do highway and bridge construction. At that time, I had 500 apprentices and or people we call on the list of availables. Those are young people that can go to work tomorrow as an apprentice. They've already been selected, but we don't take kids into apprenticeship unless we have a job for them. There were 500 of them available. That was a few months ago. It's got worse since then. I will probably, if you wish, give you an update as to the unemployment in the construction industry. We are the hardest hit area of Oregon employment, mm-hmm. is the construction industry. I've not had a chance to look at the new number that came out yesterday where, in general, the state hit 9%. I did discuss with the coordinator for the Cement Masons apprenticeship program just yesterday that if he doesn't start seeing more work, they're going to start losing these apprentices. They'll simply have to go find something else to do. So I just wanted to share that with you. I know you're all familiar with what I'm saying, but that's the realities of what's going on out there. So I am going to follow up with some suggestions from that I would like to share with you on what could perhaps happen. And I'll quit with just one thing that maybe the committee might pursue because you seem to be interested and you're asking a lot of the right questions. My counterpart in Minnesota I know very well, and I'm going to call him and ask him, how did that happen in Minnesota? I've read a lot about it. They used a lot of precast materials. I do know that. Mm-hmm. An interesting design. But I'm going to ask him for more specifics, and I'll share those with you if I get them. And in closing, I just wanted to say that when we did OTIA 3, when we first got started, Mr. Chairman, I was over at ODOT, and it seemed to me, and it's been brought up by a couple of you today, that there was some additional steps, let's say, in getting these bridge projects started, which I thought was unusual because these were repairs of existing bridges. So why did we have public hearings? Why did we have to look at fish and wildlife stuff? Why did we go through a land use process, essentially, as I understand, to fix something that was already there? And it might be a question you might ask, and you might ask, oh, well, what Was there a cost-benefit analysis to all that? I'm not suggesting it caused a long delay, but I'd never heard of it being done before. So just volunteer that.
Thank you, Mr. Shipwreck.
That's all I got to say.
Thank you. Mr. Tribbett, welcome.
For the record, my name is Ryan Tribbett with PacWest Communications here on behalf of the Building Trades Council, IBW Local 48, IBW Local 280, Iron Workers Local 29, and Operating Engineers Local 701. First and foremost, our number one goal is for the package that is put together to be sizable enough to stimulate the economy in both the short and long term, that package is viable, can pass out of the building, and then that it can be defensible to the general public. I think in terms of the size, we're comfortable with the overall size of the governor's package. I think there are some tweaks to it that can help in terms of getting it passed through the building and making it more defensible. Couldn't agree more with what Bob just said about the 2-cent gas tax. We're happy to run up the hill with you all on that, but it needs to be worth the effort. And 2 cents is just not enough. If it was something more like 6 to 10 cents, and then on the fees again, in terms of making it defensible, tripling and doubling of fees, I think is an attack that you wouldn't want to have from other people on you. Certainly support the transit elements, Connect Oregon, continuation of that program, particularly. And one thing that is not in the governor's proposal, he did put $15 million toward the Columbia River Crossing project, which is the minimum amount to keep the project going. And I know you guys have studied this project a lot. Oregon's share of it's going to be upwards of $1 billion, and we just can't fathom a scenario where we can actually bond $1 billion for one bridge in Portland. So it would make prudent sense, logical sense to create a fund and to start diverting some significant dollars into that fund so that we're not going to be bonding it all away next session when the CRC bill probably comes through.
Thank you, Mr. Tribbett. Questions for any of our guests? No. Okay, thank you very much. And one thing I'll say just for people who are listening, and this is not news to anyone here, but to Mr. Tribbett's comment about the 2-cent gas tax, I don't know at the end of the day what our package is going to look like, honestly. I'm sure Senator Starr will tell you the same thing and other members. And we've been talking about this for a long time, but we know the synergies that we need to listen and put something together that as all of you have said, meets the needs of the state and will be sustainable and will be successful. So always going to be open to that. However, just to make it very clear, there is absolutely no way that the chair will ever do a 2-cent gas tax in this session at all, for the exact reason Mr. Tribbett articulated. We all know that if there is to be a gas tax, and that's still to be decided, that it is the political effort on 2 cents is no different than $2. If you're going to make the effort, let's make it buy something and not have fight a battle that doesn't produce the results. So, you know, the gas tax issue is opened, but I will tell you right here and now that it will not fight that battle for something that doesn't get the job done for Oregon. So, yeah. End of that particular issue. Okay, we're almost done with the people I've asked you, then we're going to have anybody else who would like to talk before we leave today. And that's Frank Nussbaum and Danielle Wellever.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Fred Nussbaum. I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates. There's an advantage to be coming in at the end of a bunch of other speakers and that I can steal and piggyback on a lot of the comments people have made. The topic of least cost planning came up. I think Mr. Russell brought it up first. I don't have a lot of silver bullets to offer you in terms of where we can get more money. There's, you know, little pieces here and there. We certainly support the governor's budget, his proposal, the Jobs and Transportation Act, and all the features in there, because it provides money for our constituency. But for us, the main issue is not so much on the supply side of the revenue as it is on the other side, and this concept of least cost planning, which we have not done in this state very well. And least cost planning is not only about the environmental and the full cost-benefit allocations, but you need to have alternatives to do your analysis for, so you can pick out the solution to the problem that is provides the most benefit for the least cost. And as long as we have these silos of funding in our state, we have a little bit of dedicated funds that are now being proposed for multimodal projects, and we've got the gas tax and the highway trust fund over here for the highway end of things, and we've got the elderly and disabled funds for doing elderly and disabled transportation, we're not going to get efficient use of our tax dollars because we can't do least cost planning. If I've got a problem, for instance, the Columbia River crossing, and I have, well, maybe that's a bad one. Let's pick another one where there's actually funding identified or available, realistic funds available from the highway side of things. I can't talk about a rail solution there that might have the same or similar effect because there's no money on the rail side to come up with a solution anywhere near to what adding a lane or, you know, building a bigger bridge will do. And yet, perhaps the rail solution or some combination of rail, transit, truck lanes, whatever, might do the job better than just adding another lane for freeway or on a bridge. So I know that's hard, but I think if you take a look at some of the successes of where other governments have gone out and successfully gotten major increases in revenues from the public, even now, even within the last few years. One of the things that has been key to that is a vision of where we want our transportation system to go. Our highway system, our rail system, our passenger rail system especially, if we can go to people and say, this is what we would like to see in the state, hourly rail service between Eugene and Portland and beyond, so that now you have a choice between either driving on a congested freeway or taking the train every hour. You know, right now we don't have that option. We have two trains a day plus a couple of buses. And by the way, I want to thank you for having this meeting in the afternoon, because I can get down from Portland by the state-sponsored bus service. I could not do that for an 8 o'clock meeting because we don't have that service right now. Let's see.
What time does your return bus, by the way? I want to make sure
actually,
I get you out. Because we only got two of them a day, and I wouldn't want to see you on the front of the Capitol. Or, okay.
Well, actually, my wife is also down here, so I can get
oh, okay,
down.
Good. Okay. Well, I was concerned.
thank you, sir. So, I guess I don't want to spend too much of your time. I'm glad to answer any questions and ideas here. Some things that we've kicked around in our group and with other people is, in terms of funding for a rail service, for instance, is there's a fuel tax on railroads right now. Where does that money go? It goes into the highway fund. That money should be... We should be able to take the proportion that comes from the use of fuel in the state of Oregon for railroads to go for railroad uses. There's a property tax on railroads in this state. It now goes to the counties. Maybe some of that needs to go into improving the rail system. These are just a few. Mr. Martin talked about the problem with the elderly and disabled and the whole connection between the Salem Transit District. Part of our problem in this state, because of this siloing of programs, is that the Department of Human Services is paying a whole lot of subsidy to basically taxi people from places like Medford and Ashland all the way up to the Veterans Hospital in Portland. One passenger being driven up. Okay, we have in Salem, we have this problem, we have the lift service. Regular passengers can't use the lift service. why don't we open up the Lyft service, the elderly and disabled service, to regular passengers when they have capacity to do that? Those are fair-paying passengers. They can help defray the cost. We can't do that because we've got these boxes that we're all into. So if there's any way that you guys can help to get local and state agencies to think more in comprehensively, I think we could use the money that we have more effectively. The last thing I'll say, you've heard about, you know, problems with transit. You've heard problems with railroads that are being addressed pretty well, the freight railroads being addressed pretty well through Connect Oregon, hopefully Connect Oregon 3. What we don't have in this state is a good intercity transportation, public transportation system. As we all are getting older, many of us hope to retire to some of the smaller communities in our state. When we get there, when we get to Bend, when we get to the coast, Yahats, or wherever, we're stuck unless we can drive our cars. We have no decent public transportation that ties those places together. And I think a lot of people are prevented from moving into some of these communities that are having economic distress right now because they don't feel they can get around. So that needs to be, we don't have an agency in our state that really focuses on that problem. We've got the rail division that also takes care of our passenger rail. We've got public transit that is looking mainly at elderly and disabled services and public transit issues in metropolitan and urban areas. We don't have an agency that is looking overall state. How do we move people from our rural areas to our cities, between our rural areas, and so on? Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Welliver.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Metzger, Chair Metzger, and members of the committee. My name is Danielle Welliver. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I'm here today to talk to you about the Governor's Transportation Package and our support of it. We have been working with Environment Oregon and the Oregon Environmental Council to promote a healthy transportation package for Oregon. We think that the Governor's Transportation Package does that. It's a systemic approach. It's integrated, and we hope that you can hold all the pieces together as you move forward throughout the session and you make all the difficult choices that you are going to need to make. I want to highlight a couple of the pieces that were in that package. One of them had to do with the metropolitan planning organizations and a requirement that they do transportation land use planning targeting greenhouse gas goals that the legislature set last session. That piece was accidentally, as we understand it, left out of the governor's bill, and we hope that it will be put back in soon. The other piece that I wanted to mention just was the funding for multimodal investments. We support it as the governor has laid it out, and we hope that you will too. We look forward to working with you throughout the session and doing whatever we can to support integrated, healthy transportation system. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question.
Sure.
Well, over just, and I had this conversation with actually Senator Starr last night. So I'm just going to throw that at you cold. But Mr. Charles mentioned about congestion pricing and how the federal government's been trying to encourage, I think New York was offered $300 million to do congestion pricing, which we know has significant reduction in greenhouse gases as well as making our lives more convenient. But when you talk to the public about congestion pricing, they nod and smile and I want to be less congested. And then when you tell them what that means sometimes, then it's where you get political pushback, you know, whether it's tolling or whatever. And yet, I think it's clear, particularly in our large metropolitan areas, that we can't just build our way out of it. We have to encourage the use in a different way. And congestion pricing is part of that. And it's worked very well in London and a lot of places, but bringing that experience to our own community is difficult. And so one of the things I was toying with is you know, how do you use that incentive to help expedite the political problem where in the back room they want to do it, but they just don't know how they move towards it. And I was wondering just your off-the-top reaction to what if this legislature were to set aside a significant amount of money from the Department of Transportation. I'm going to make up a figure like $25 million. I don't know why that would be a right figure, knowing that there are federal opportunities there for a pilot program with an MPO, which would have to basically describe the Portland area. If they were to initiate a congestion pricing model, so that the obstacle of there wasn't money to do it could be removed, and you could actually have the serious discussion with the people in the most congested part of our state, look seriously at doing a pilot program along those lines. What would be your thought about that?
Thank you for the question, Chair Metzger. It is a very good question, and I will talk with Bob Stacey, Executive Director of Thousand Friends, and the other people, Environment Oregon, Oregon Environmental Council, and have them get you an answer. I am not prepared to answer that question.
Well, I understand. It's but one of the things we deal with, and as you do, and all of you advocate, you know, there's political issues, and then there's funding issues, and sometimes that if you can take one of those off the table, it does put all of us in the political arena on a more of a spot, but that's kind of what we need to be to find out whether we're really willing to have those conversations sooner rather than later, and that's just one of the issues. The other one that was mentioned in Mr. Charles' testimony, and we were going to do this bill tomorrow, we're going to wait about a month, but we will make it very clear, although we believe the City of Portland and Multnomah County already have authority to toll their Willamette River bridges. Multnomah County has, on a number of occasions, has commented they don't think the authority is clear. And we will take care of that. We have a bill for that, and we'll probably hear that next month, and make it very clear that at least that tool is in their toolbox and that there is no political opposition or any kind of impediment on a state level, so that they can have those discussions at such time. Because I think that as we look at the governor's funding proposal, we look at our state goals for reducing greenhouse gases, as we look at trying to use the infrastructure that we do have better and more efficiently, we're going to have to be able to remove the obstacles so that we can seriously get down to actually making the decisions on some of this. So let me see if there's any questions from the committee. Senator Berger?
I have a quick question on the standards that were set by the governor, and you said that was left out. And are you referring to cap and trade?
No, not at all, Senator, or Chairman Metzger, Senator Berger. It had to do with just a little planning piece, just specifically for the metropolitan planning organizations to just when they do their planning, to calculate in how they would target that greenhouse gas reduction goal that's already been set, just for their transportation land use planning. For example, where do you build your roads? What's the right mix of transit, bicycle? How compact is your development? Those kinds of things.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes.
I'd like to respond to your question about congestion pricing. I think my organization's is a little bit concerned about congestion pricing and how it would be implemented. I think what is not clear from the studies that John Charles mentioned is how much traffic is being diverted off to other roads, number one. Maybe I'm not familiar particularly with I-91 to what goes on there, but certainly in the Portland area we have lots of parallel facilities. Along I-5 we have Barber Boulevard, along I-84 we have all kinds of major streets there, so that needs to be carefully figured out if you're going to do a piecemeal approach to congestion pricing. The other thing for us is that we have to make sure that the proceeds from that doesn't just go to maintaining the road system, but also provides the alternative so people that don't want to travel, don't want to pay the higher toll, can use transit or some other alternative to make that same trip.
Yeah.
If that's separated out, then we have a problem.
Well, you're absolutely right, and so we're not going to debate. You know, we're not going to put the model together today, but we need to get moving. And I do want to see if there's anybody else that wants to testify, because we're almost out of time.
Real quick question.
Real quick answer. Whatever his question is. Okay. So,
just following up on what you just said, I think I calculate. I've spent the last 6 years. I've probably been in 45 or 50 different countries, and I always use the transportation system they have there. And I've actually found the most efficient way for me as a traveler to get around most countries is actually through bus systems. And the more developed the bus system, the easier it is. Even if they have train systems, the buses always seem to be the most efficient. So I guess for your organization, if a bus system, maybe taking some of the advice we heard about deregulating some of the private transportation, and we get into and we find the buses are much more efficient, is your organization saying rail no matter what, or if there's actually facts, you would actually go with something that may perhaps not be passenger rail?
My organization is multimodal. It's whatever mode makes the most sense, has the most cost benefit for a particular market. So we are not against buses, and we do not say rail or light rail for every solution. We've actually been officially on the ballot against certain light rail projects because it was not cost effective.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. We have about 8 minutes left, and of course this is only our first meeting, so don't get any angst. We're going to have so many of these. Is there anybody else in the public who would like to just testify on any of the funding mechanisms proposed for transportation at this time? Okay. Colleagues, we will meet tomorrow at 1 o'clock. We have our first set of bills. I never know when you first start out what they are. They are agency bills. They look like we could have a quick meeting, but at least our workload will begin. Senator Starr and I will be meeting every Tuesday, starting next Tuesday, to go over our agenda. You're getting the referral list, so please, as you see something in particular that's coming to our committee that you have particular interest in or whatever, be sure to contact myself or Senator Starr. Give us a heads up as we work with Mr. Stanbridge to schedule, because a lot of this stuff will come, and otherwise we're kind of in many cases going off the top of our heads in terms of putting the schedule together, and we would certainly accommodate your particular interest in trying to move some of these things. It's going to be a very interesting session. I think there's a lot expected of this committee, and I know we're going to deliver on it, and all of you in the audience and those who have been listening in, we're going to need your help. And with that, Senator Schrader, are you still with us?
I'm still with you, and I just wanted to comment and thank you, colleagues, for allowing me to join you via phone. And as I said, I can see you. You can't see me, but I just wanted to let everyone know I took copious notes. And I will be joining you tomorrow using the same media that I've used today for our meeting. So I do look forward to joining you once again tomorrow. And then I will obviously be back for the rest of the session. So well, thank you so much for allowing me this opportunity.
Well, thank you, Senator Schrader. And we are hoping that we'll give you one assignment. You have some connections back there, I understand.
Yeah.
And if you can bring a boatload of money with you from the feds, that would just be absolutely wonderful.
Mr. Chairman, oh, I think
the congressman is already expecting some heavy-duty lobbying from this arena, so I'll assure him that's going to happen.
Okay.
Well, Senator Schrader, I think the chairman was very nice to allow anyone who danced at the inaugural ball
to tune in
today.
Well, it was quite the experience, very exciting times, and I do know that all of our delegation is going to be working on the stimulus package. There's a lot of energy here, and I know that they're going to be looking out for the welfare of Oregon and its citizens. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schrader. Thank you, colleagues. We're adjourned.